At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Power up fall projects with Ego at Lowe's. Every tool delivers power beyond belief. So whether it's leaves, limbs, or lawn cleanup, count on Ego to deliver the power, performance, and innovation you need. And now for a limited time, save up to $60 on select blowers, chainsaws, and pole saws. Shop Ego today at Lowe's. Offers valid through 10-1 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news. But before we do, I wanted to thank everyone for reviewing us over at Apple Podcasts. Like I said before, it really helps the show. So if you haven't done that, if you could just pause this for a second, head over to Apple Podcasts, give us that 5-star review, leave a few nice words about us, and we'd really, really appreciate it. I also wanted to shout out our Discord. Remember, subscribers, either monthly or annual, are able to access our Discord. A lot of really good conversations going on there recently. But in the last week, people in the Discord have raised a significant amount of money for a family in Palestine. And I wanted to say thank you to them. My understanding is that they did it in collaboration with the TruAnon Discord. And, you know, we talk about the news a lot, but the fact that we were able to make the difference on the Discord in at least one family's life really means a lot. So I just wanted to say thank you to the Discord. Check out the Crusades podcast, welcome to the crusades.com, and the Of This World podcast, ofthisworldpod.com. And as always, we really appreciate everyone's support. We've got a bunch of really good episodes coming out soon, and we know, not even think, we know you'll enjoy them. All right, let's jump in 2 feet first into the news, Derek, and let's start with Russia, Ukraine, and let's talk about this Trump-Putin summit.
Right. I'm sure people were aware that Donald Trump was hosting Vladimir Putin in Alaska on Friday, for a big summit where they were going to resolve the Ukraine war, or somehow at least advance the process of resolving the Ukraine war. Trump rolled out the red carpet literally for Putin, treated him in every way as a visiting dignitary. This is, of course, a man who's wanted for arrest by the International Criminal Court, but the U.S. isn't party to the ICC, so that's okay. In fact, we sanction it. So there was no violation there, I suppose. But the optics of Putin getting this reception, I think, raised some eyebrows, let's say. In terms of what they discussed, whatever actually transpired in the negotiations between the two of them, which were short, they were much shorter. The whole event was much shorter than it was supposed to be, I think around half as long as people had anticipated. They left without taking questions from reporters, which suggests in the moment that somebody wasn't terribly pleased with what took place. And afterwards, Trump, who had been saying all along that his goal for this summit was to achieve a ceasefire in Ukraine, and had said as recently as Friday morning that he would be very unhappy if he and Putin didn't agree on a ceasefire, declared on social media that Ukraine and Russia should go directly to a peace agreement and not worry about a ceasefire. So he completely 180'd himself on the issue of the ceasefire, which, you know, there's no value judgment here necessarily. I mean, Putin has resisted a ceasefire, and at some point you stop, you know, kind of bashing your head into a brick wall and accept that he's just not interested in a ceasefire and move on to something that could be more productive. I get that. It's just sort of startling the speed with which Trump went from his focus being on a ceasefire to disavowing a ceasefire altogether without really explaining or mentioning the shift, just sort of making it as he's wont to do. The impression I gather that Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, and several European leaders got when Trump debriefed them on the summit immediately afterwards, and then through the day on Saturday as he was sort of pronouncing things about ceasefires and Ukraine needing to give up land and, you know, sacrificing this and sacrificing that, was that they were quite concerned with the direction that things were going. It was sort of, I think they had felt going in after they had their pre-summit meeting with Trump, that everybody was on the same page, and suddenly he was, you know, off on a different page. Putin reportedly in terms of the territorial question, which is one of the big outstanding questions, demanded that Ukraine give up the remainder of the Donbass, which includes a healthy chunk of Donetsk Oblast that Russia does not control at present. Basically that Ukraine give this up as a preliminary step, as a precursor to negotiations, in return for which Putin said he would agree to freeze the front line at its current position in the non-Donbass provinces that Russia claims to have annexed. That's Kherson and Zaporizhia. Those front lines have been frozen de facto for quite some time now because there's simply no movement happening. But he offered to freeze the front lines at those points if the Ukrainians, as a good faith gesture, I guess, gave him a big chunk of territory that his military doesn't currently control. So things did not necessarily go in the direction that the Ukrainians and the Europeans wanted. So they hurriedly scheduled what seemed very much like a damage control meeting at the White House on Monday. Initially, Zelensky was supposed to go, and then I think to avoid the possibility of a repeat of what happened earlier this year when he went to the White House and got dressed down on the couch in the Oval Office and U.S.-Ukrainian relations were set back quite a bit. All of the European coalition of the willing, or most of them, so-called coalition of the willing members, their leaders also attended: Giorgia Meloni, Keir Starmer, Emmanuel Macron, Friedrich Merz, the Chancellor of Germany. All of these guys showed up as well for, I think, moral support to keep things on the straight and narrow. And basically, they do seem to have talked Trump down from some of the positions that he took after the summit. He's sort of shifted again, which he does. The last, you know, voice in his ear is the one that he listens to. So he shifted again in Ukraine's direction. We're left at the point where, and I know this was one of the questions previewing Sunday's bonus episode that I asked Charles Kupchan. It's an open question whether anything has actually changed here after the big summit with Putin, after the big meeting, post-summit meeting in the White House on Monday, whether there's anything that has actually changed regarding Ukrainian ceasefire or peace deal. I don't really think there's some additional talk of security guarantees now. Trump has expressed some willingness to support a European security force that I still have a hard time imagining is ever going to come into existence.
They've been trying to do that for 80 American years, by the power. Way. It's not
right,
going to happen.
Right, right. But that you know, they could put some kind of tripwire force in Ukraine to discourage the Russians from invading again someday. And that the U.S., Trump now says the U.S. would be willing to support that with air power. You know, he could change his mind on that tomorrow or in the middle of, you know, setting up the operation or some other inopportune time. So I don't know how well you can rely on that. But there is some additional talk of that. I think we have a slightly better sense of where Putin is in terms of his approach to peace talks, which is he's not at a place where he's willing to give up basically anything, or concede basically anything. The Russians are back to, you know, nightly bombardments of Ukraine. There was another major one overnight into Thursday. Trump now says, and this is the latest twist in the saga, Trump is apparently telling people, this is according to The Guardian, That he's basically taking his ball and going home. Like, he's done with trying to organize a meeting. This was the other, you know, goal here, in addition to the ceasefire, was to organize a face-to-face between Zelensky and Putin, maybe with Trump also there as a three-way thing, or, you know, just the two of them. Trump now says he's sort of done with this. He's not going to bother with it. Zelensky and Putin can meet whenever they decide they want to meet, and then Trump may join them for a three-way summit after that, but he's not going to put any more focus on trying to get them to meet. So he may be at the point where he's just tired of this whole thing and wants to move on to something else. And as I say, the actual amount of movement here, despite all the festivities and the focus, seems to be pretty negligible.
All right, let's move on to the most depressing story of the week. I don't know. Well, let's see. Let's talk about Israel-Palestine, and let's talk about Hamas.
No, it's pretty much
as usual.
Story every week.
Let's talk about Hamas accepting the ceasefire, what that means.
Yeah, I don't know that it means anything, but Hamas on Monday signaled its approval of a new ceasefire proposal that was put on the table by the Qatari government, one of the mediators. According to the Qataris, the proposal is almost identical. That was the term that they used, almost identical to one that the Israeli government had previously accepted and Hamas had pushed back against. It is a staged ceasefire, as all the previous proposals have been, for a 60-day initial truce, partial release of captives in Gaza, some exchange of people being held captive, Palestinians being held captive by the Israelis, some withdrawal of Israeli forces to predetermined positions, kind of on the outskirts of Gaza, an influx of humanitarian aid, like all of the material, all the ingredients of the past proposals seem to be in there. With the Israelis maybe about to invade Gaza City again, and we can talk about that, the message out of the Israeli government now that Hamas has agreed to this framework is, and they're going to provide they're going to give their formal response, I think, by Friday. So, you know, maybe it will have happened by the time people listen to this. But the messaging coming out of the Israeli government and Netanyahu's office is that they're suddenly, after, you know, for pretty much this entire time, insisting on staged ceasefire deals that would allow the Israeli military to resume its activities, to resume killing people, to resume starving people, to resume the ethnic cleansing of Gaza, after a certain period of time, after insisting on that structure, they are now suddenly no longer interested in a staged ceasefire, and now they want a full all for all captive release. They want all the captives in Gaza freed. They want, you know, Hamas to disarm and all these other maximalist objectives that they're aiming for, and they're not willing to settle anymore, apparently, for a staged ceasefire. This seems like just a justification for rejecting a deal that basically they had already accepted in a previous round of negotiations, it sounds like. But we'll see. I would not take much optimism away from Hamas accepting this framework, because I think the Israelis will find a reason. If they're not already telegraphing it, they'll find a reason to reject it.
All right, let's talk about this Gaza City operation.
This has been this has gone through a number of layers in the Israeli government. So Israel Katz, the Israeli defense minister, on Wednesday gave what he said was his approval to the Gaza City operation that's been on the cards for some time now. The IDF, the Israeli military, is going to move in and capture, conquer, seize, I don't know what term you want to use, the city again. And this would not be the first time it's done so since the October 7th attacks. Beyond that, we don't really know very much. Katz said he had called up 60,000 reservists, or had authorized the call up of 60,000 reservists to participate in the operation. This is at least the fourth approval that some senior Israeli official or body has given to this operation. It had to be approved by the security cabinet It's been approved by Benjamin Netanyahu at least twice now, I think. It's been approved by the IDF, the Uniform Command. Now it's been approved by Katz, the civilian overseer of the Israeli military. They're going through a lot of mechanics to make it look like this operation is going forward. They claimed on Wednesday that the first stages, or what they call the preliminary operations of the attack on Gaza City, had begun. But that just seemed to amount to some clearance operations and very heavy air bombardments of kind of eastern neighborhoods of Gaza City and its suburbs, which they'd already been doing for several days prior to Wednesday. So I'm not entirely clear what's changed yet, or what the timetable is for the Israelis to actually move into Gaza City. And they may be taking their time with this. The call up of 60,000 reservists suggests that they're not going to be ready for the intense phase of the operation for at least as long as it takes to actually mobilize those people, which could be a little bit of time. I don't know if there's some expectation, or they're giving time to see if Hamas decides to surrender according to the wishes of Netanyahu and company. They claim that they're trying to give time for people to evacuate, basically for them to be displaced from their homes in and around Gaza City into the camps that the Israelis have set up in southern Gaza. You know, that's probably part of it. Certainly the ethnic cleansing component of all this can't be ruled out. But it's still a little bit unclear exactly what pace they're on here, and when this operation that they've been talking about for a couple of weeks now is actually going to begin in earnest.
Thank you, Derek. All right, let's talk about this E1 settlement, which is happening in the West Bank that the Israeli government has approved. What is that, and how are things in general going in the West Bank?
Not good. The E1 settlement is sort of the capstone of the Israeli far-right settler movement's attempt to de facto annex the West Bank and prevent the creation of a Palestinian state. Bezalel Smotrich, one of the leading lights of that movement, the finance minister in the Israeli government, who also oversees the civilian aspects of West Bank settlement from his perch in the defense ministry, said last week that he was preparing to get approval for this E1 settlement plan. This has been something that the Israeli right in particular has been talking about doing since the 1990s, at least. Initially, it was looked at as an expansion of the Maale Adumim settlement in the West Bank, which is east of Jerusalem. It's now, I think, its own thing, its own standalone thing. It's not just an expansion of another settlement. But essentially, it would connect that settlement to, or run that the settlements all the way up to Jerusalem, to East Jerusalem. It would bisect the West Bank north to south. So there would be a line of settlements basically running across the West Bank, dividing the northern part of the territory from the southern part of the territory. As I say, it's essentially a death knell to any lingering hopes that you're gonna build a contiguous Palestinian state in the West Bank. And Smotrich and company have said this. I mean, when he announced last week that he was gonna try to get approval for it, he said this will bury the idea of a Palestinian state, and that's really the goal, and it's very controversial for that reason. So the settlement project did get approval on Wednesday. So Smotrich followed through on his promise to do that. We'll see how quickly they kind of move forward with building settlements. It's already gotten a pretty heavy condemnation from outside Israel. The German government even condemned it. You know, European governments have condemned it. It's been extreme. It's been viewed as extreme even by typical West Bank settlement standards because of the effect that it will have on the West Bank in terms of the political reality on the ground. So pretty provocative step. We'll you know, see how quickly the Israelis move to implement it now that they've decided to go ahead.
Thanks, Derek. Let's move over to India-China, one of the major geopolitical rivalries that will probably define the 21st century. Let's talk about Wang Yi visiting India.
Yeah, it's not so much of a rivalry right now, which is interesting. Wang Yi visited New Delhi this week. He met with various Indian officials, including Narendra Modi, the prime minister. Modi affirmed that he will attend the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit in China later this month. That is will be his first visit to China, I believe, in 7 years, I've seen reported. So there's a bit of a thaw in this relationship. People may recall that a couple of years ago, there was a big border, fatal border clash between Chinese and Indian forces that really soured relations for quite some time, but they've sort of put that past them. We're starting to trend back to at least normalcy, which is not a close relationship, but at least a tolerable relationship where they're interacting at a basic level. Now, in the last couple of months, they've gotten a real boost from the fact that Donald Trump has decided that he's mad at the Indian government for, we don't really know why, he's put 50% effectively tariffs on Indian products. 25% is sort of his normal reciprocal tariff, and then he doubled that as a penalty, supposedly, for India continuing to buy Russian oil despite U.S. sanctions. That seems to be cover for something else. I don't know exactly what. I think he's mad in part because Modi, after Trump claimed to have mediated the resolution of the India-Pakistan conflict in Kashmir earlier this year, Modi strenuously rejected the notion that Trump had anything to do with it. I think Trump may be pissed off about that. Regardless, he is coming after the Indian government suddenly, abruptly, in a big way economically. And so India is moving toward China a little bit, which is strategically a huge shift for the United States. It's been trying to get India, draw India into the anti-China Indo-Pacific alliance structure for years now. And Trump seems to be frittering that away. Not to say that India and China will ever be the best of friends, but clearly, you know, there's been a step back here in terms of trying to open more daylight between them and get India, draw India closer to the U.S.
With Robinhood, not only can you trade individual stocks and ETFs, you can also seamlessly buy and sell crypto at low costs. Trade all in one place. Get started now on Robinhood. Trading crypto involves significant risk. Crypto trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Crypto LLC. Robinhood Crypto is licensed to engage in virtual currency business activity by the New York State Department of Financial Services. Crypto held through Robinhood Crypto is not FDIC insured or SIPC protected. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Securities trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Financial LLC. Member SIPC, a registered broker-dealer.
Let's move over to Myanmar and let's talk about the junta there scheduling an election.
Yeah, just briefly. I mean, the junta has been advertising that it's going to hold elections at some point this year to ostensibly transition back to some semblance of civilian rule. It announced on Monday that it's scheduling that election, it's scheduling the general election for December 28th. So it will apparently achieve the, you know, fulfill this promise by the end of the year. There's a lot of questions, obviously, about how you can have an election in a country that is riven by civil war or various civil wars, rebel factions controlling big chunks of the country. The junta having not a lot of public support, it would seem. So how it's going to pull off an election. And then, of course, there are understandable questions about what kind of election it's going to be. Is it going to be a sort of farcical thing that just kind of reifies military power under a different guise? Or is it going to be legitimate? I suspect more the former than the latter. But yeah, lots of questions about this. But it is noteworthy that they have scheduled, at least they've set the date for the contest.
All right, Derek, thank you as always. Let's talk about the DRC and let's talk about the government there's negotiations with M23 faltering.
Yeah, so as people may know, the Congolese government and M23 rebel group were supposed to, under the Qatari-mediated peace process that they're both ostensibly engaged in, were supposed to begin meeting for a final round of talks earlier this month with a view toward signing a final peace accord on Monday, on the 18th. It is now Friday as people are listening to this, and not only is there now no peace accord, they never actually opened that final round of talks. So things are very much in limbo at this point. M23 has been accused of carrying out a number of massacres of civilian populations in villages in the eastern DRC, the territory that it controls in North Kivu province and South Kivu province. They have accused the Congolese government of not implementing some of the terms of the statement of principles that the two parties agreed to, I believe, last month. Confidence building measures that were supposed to feed into this final round of negotiations that never happened. The Qatari government did say on Sunday that it had submitted a new proposed peace deal to both parties. So the Qataris still seem to be optimistic that this can be salvaged. From what I've seen, the AP reported on a draft of that peace proposal, it would eventually restore both provinces that are currently held by M23 to the control of the Congolese government. But for some reason, and it's not clear why, the terms have been deemed unacceptable by Congolese President Felix Tshisekedi. So I don't know what that means. There's no indication of what he finds objectionable. But clearly, this is a process that is faltering. And there's some work to be done here to try and get it back on track.
Let's talk about the U.S. sending warships to Venezuela.
This is a fun one. Yeah, the U.S. is apparently, the U.S. military is deploying three naval destroyers to the waters off Venezuela. I don't know exactly what that means. They are somehow supposed to combat threats. This is according to the AP, combat threats from Latin American drug cartels. This is in keeping with an order that Donald Trump apparently signed fairly recently, ordering the U.S. military to do something about drug trafficking in the Americas. Now, Venezuela is an interesting target because, of course, the Trump administration has it out for Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela. It doubled the bounty on the U.S. bounty on his head to $50 million recently. It has accused him of basically running two, at this point, I think, criminal gangs and trying to, quote unquote, invade the United States with both migrants and drugs. So clearly it has it out for Maduro and moving these destroyers to the waters off Venezuela could be viewed as part of a, let's say a regime challenge operation or regime change operation, if one were inclined to view it that way. So I think this is maybe something to keep an eye on. In and of itself, moving around a couple of destroyers, not that big a deal, but I think given the pattern of behavior we've seen toward Venezuela, toward Maduro, it's something to watch.
Thank you, Derek. And we're going to do something new here. We're going to talk a little bit about a news story, and then we're going to insert a interview. But Derek, why don't we start with, tell us a little bit about the Bolivia election results.
Right. The first round, Bolivia held its general election on Sunday, which included the first round of the presidential election. No candidate won with the margin that would have produced a first round victory. So they will go to a second round in October. That was expected. Polling had been pretty consistent that nobody was going to win a first round knockout. But what was surprising is the identity of one of the two people who will be in the runoff. Polling previously had suggested that former Bolivian President Jorge Quiroga would face a business person named Samuel Doria Medina, in the runoff, but Medina finished in third place and sent a centrist. He's sort of casting himself as a centrist. I don't know that I buy that, but Rodrigo Paz won the first round. So Quiroga finished in second place. Paz won out of nowhere, basically, based on where he was in the polling before the election. So those two will head to the runoff. Paz would seem to have the edge going into that. It was a bad night for the Bolivian left, as I think people may have been aware. Polling was not optimistic about that. The Movement for Socialism Party, which has fallen apart amid a dispute between Evo Morales and Luis Arce, the former president and the incumbent, their candidate, Eduardo del Castillo, finished with, I think, somewhere around 3% of the vote. The other major leftist on the ballot, Andronico Rodriguez, president of the Bolivian Senate, finished in the high single digits, but neither one of them was anywhere close. So Danny, as you say, I spoke to Olivia Arrigo Stiles from the University of Manchester. So Olivia and I spoke longer about the future of the MAS, about what may happen as a result of the election in terms of Bolivia's indigenous community and the possibility of unrest. And paid subscribers, if you stick around at the end of this, you can listen to the rest of that interview. If you are not a paid subscriber, then you should be a paid subscriber. And then if you become a paid subscriber, you can listen to the rest of the interview. Olivia, thank you so much for coming on the program. Let's start with the surprise outcome. The Senator Rodrigo Paz, defying polling, came in first place in Sunday's first round of the election. He will face former President Jorge Quiroga in October in a runoff. That part was not surprising, but Paz was. So let's start with, who is Rodrigo Paz, and how did he defy polling to wind up in first place here and heading into the runoff?
Yeah. Thank you, Derek. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. Absolute bombshell results from the elections on Sunday in Bolivia. So, as you've said, Tuto Quiroga is going to take on Rodrigo Paz in a second round of elections in October to determine who's going to be president. Now, this is pretty much a battle between one establishment extreme right winger in the form of Tuto Quiroga and, as you've mentioned, Rodrigo Paz, this kind of new entity. And he's really positioning himself as this kind of anti-establishment, sort of Milei of Bolivia, liberal right wing with, we might say, elements of populism. Now, these results were completely surprising. They came out of nowhere. So nobody was predicting this. So the polls for the past few weeks have been, without a shadow of a doubt, they've put Tuto Quiroga and Samuel Doria Medina, also a sort of soft right-wing candidate, in front place. So, yeah, out of this comes Rodrigo Paz, but crucially, his vice president, Edman Lara, or El Capitan, as he calls himself. He's the vice presidential candidate. And a lot of people are saying that Rodrigo Paz owes this rather surprising success to him. Who is Capitan Lara? Firstly, he is this kind of anti-corruption zealot. He's a former police officer. He's a TikTok star. And he's really presents himself as this kind of strongman figure. So he appears in videos in sort of football jerseys. And his main message is around anti-corruption. So he's really this kind of anti-corruption sort of advocate. And clearly this message resonated very deeply at a time when there's a lot of disillusionment with the governing party, the MAS, but also politicians of all stripes. So something that we saw in the elections on Sunday was a lot of discontent at polling stations. Andronico Rodriguez, for example, the ex-MAS sort of figure and leader of Alianza Popular, was pelted with rocks when he went to vote. So there's been a lot of anti-establishment sentiment. And out of this emerged a very strong current of support for Capitan Lara and for the Rodrigo Paz. Now, Rodrigo Paz is not exactly an anti-establishment figure. He's senator from Tarija. He's the son of Jaime Paz, a very famous president who served who ruled Bolivia in the late 80s. This kind of a soft anti-neoliberal figure, not unpopular. But Rodrigo Paz is definitely not an anti-establishment figure. But Capitan Lara has really come to the fore as his vice president, and particularly won a lot of support from rural voters. So that's the kind of, yeah, in a nutshell, what's happened on Sunday.
Looking ahead to October, what's the sentiment in terms of whether Paz is likely to win or if Quiroga has a chance? I think Medina has already endorsed Paz, but I could be wrong about that. Which would seem to, since Medina finished in a, you know, somewhat distant but still relatively strong third place, that would seem to give Paz a leg up. But what is the sort of state of play look like for the runoff?
Yeah, so a number of sectors have come out in support of Paz. So, for example, the peasant unions are orienting themselves around or Lara, but yeah, Paz. It's still not clear what's going to happen. So Paz won about a 5% lead over Tuto Quiroga. But here the kind of question of regions, I think, comes into play. So Tuto has a core support base in Santa Cruz, Pando, and Beni. So this is kind of the center of sort of agro industry, very powerful sector. Tuto is also, you know, he's been around a long time. He's a kind of, he was vice president under the dictator Hugo Banza. He later served a year as president. So he's definitely not to be underestimated. So this might depend on kind of, yeah, a number of factors. I mean, the rural vote seems to be swinging towards Paz. And it is this is kind of the big shock. And Paz himself today came out and said he owes his support to Achacachi and to the Ponchos Rojos. Now, Achacachi is this historic center of radicalism, of Aymara insurgency. So he's really trying to position himself as trying to scoop up disillusioned mass voters. And with the lead that he has, it's looking like he is actually the favorite. But there's 2 months to go. The next round of elections will be in October. So anything could happen. The other interesting dynamic here is that between Rodrigo Paz and Capitan Lara, Lara actually seems to be the more popular figure here. So are people coming out to vote really on the basis of Capitan Lara? And can Rodrigo Paz kind of continue to kind of count on this support? It's kind of created this interesting tension. Capitan Lara even came out and said that if he found that Rodrigo Paz had committed any corruption, he would denounce him. So there's this sort of a sense of there might be a bit of tension between these two candidates. That's something we'll have to see what happens in October.
Well, that sets things up perfectly for a stable administration. Wow, to have your vice president threatening to denounce you. That's great. What is Paz run? I guess this gets into, maybe we can start to talk about what happened to the MAS here, what happened to the Bolivian left more broadly. But in terms of what Paz himself was campaigning on with Lara, who, as you said, is this kind of anti-corruption figure, it also seems like he positioned himself as the kind of the anti-establishment. Like he's running against Mas, but he's also reminding people that, hey, you know, Quiroga represents an establishment, a right-wing neoliberal establishment that you all didn't like either, which is why Mas came to power in the first place. So he seems to be positioning himself as somewhat of a third pole. What would that look like if he wins, or what can we say anything at this point about what that might look like?
Yeah, I mean, if we kind of dig down into some of the policy programs. Now, Paz has been sort of remarkably vague on questions around the economy. Now, at the moment in Bolivia, there is a deep economic crisis. This cannot be overstated. So there's a complete lack of dollars. There's no combustible. There's no diesel. So in the cities, you'll see cars and trucks queuing for several days. Transport cancelled because there's no diesel because the government has run out of dollars. Inflation is at 20%. The price of basic goods, food, has shot up astronomically. Imported goods, has in particular, has increased. Just the other day, I was in the supermarket and I saw an imported sun cream retailing for $80. So there is a massive economic crisis at the moment. In terms of what, therefore, the candidates, and particularly PAS and Tuto, have said they'll do, so PAS has been, if you watch videos, it's really quite a vague set of proposals, in contrast to, say, Samuel Doria Medina, who had a very clear platform, like 100 days, I'm going to bring dollars to Bolivia. PAS has instead suggested a program around access to credit, so tax breaks, and particularly this question of eliminating import barriers. Another key sort of element of his economic program has been around decentralization. So he's talked a lot about shrinking the state, shrinking the central apparatus in favor of the regions. So broadly, we're talking about kind of lower tariffs, lower taxes, more credit. And his slogan is capitalismo para todos. So this kind of, again, a sort of a vague idea about sort of delivering more money to people. Unlike Tuto, he has said he's not in favor of a bailout from the IMF. Now, Tuto, on the other hand, is very much running on this program of reducing fiscal deficit, stabilizing dollar exchange rate, but through bailouts from the IMF and the World Bank. And Tuto really represents the kind of connection with US interests here. He's fundamentally serving the interests of US capital and Bolivian traditional elites. So, as you've said, Rodrigo Paz is kind of positioning himself against that. But the other sort of thing to mention about Tuto is that he does, in some respects, from a lot of his discourse, represent a much more hardline approach to the plurinational state, for example. Now, remember that the MAS introduced in its 20-year regime, there's been massive transformations to the Bolivian society and economy, particularly around the visibility and importance of indigenous social movements. Now, Tuto, for example, has recently talked about changing land ownership structures, so outlawing TCOs, which are land rights awarded collectively to indigenous groups, for example, in favor of individual land titling. So I think with Tuto, it seems that there would be very much more sort of potentially quite extreme changes to Bolivian economy and society. So Rodrigo Paz is probably, as we can see, kind of positioning himself against that slightly, trying to maintain, trying to court the rural vote and trying not to potentially come up too strongly against some of these, some of the sort of facets of the plurinational state.
So I guess the question that people who listen to the show will be most interested in is what happened to the Bolivian left? And the one way that this outcome was not surprising was the collapse of the MAS and just the left in general. There were two leftist candidates on the ballot, both finished in single digits. There's a lot to unpack here, and I'm not asking you to kind of go through the entire story, but we have the Morales Arce feud, we have the economics collapse under Arce. Just give people sort of the broad sense of what happened here to sort of doom the left in this election.
Yeah. So as you've said, the major result from this election is the total collapse of the MAS. And really, we can say a wholesale rejection of the left. They have just one representative in the chambers. There's virtually no leftists at all in either chamber of government. So we're talking about a totally right-wing and extreme right-wing dominated legislature. Now, remember that for the past 20 years, the MAS has dominated both of these chambers, at times with an absolute majority. So whoever is president in October, they're going to be presiding over a right-wing oriented chamber. So, I mean, how did we get to this point? I mean, for the past 2 years, the MAS has been totally embroiled in divisions, a very deep split between Arcistas, those who are loyal to the current president, Luis Arce, and Evistas, the ex-president, Evo Morales. Now, this has led to a total gridlock in chambers. There's been legislation hasn't been able to be passed. And it goes beyond the sort of party infrastructure here. So the MAS is constituted through social movements, and it's known as the instruments of the people. It's a political instrument that serves the interests of the social movements. But within the social movements themselves, they are absolutely divided. So, for example, the major peasant union, Bisesutsube, completely divided in two between Arsistas and Avisas. Now, this kind of speaks to a longer term trend that has been happening since probably about 2012, which is that the mass has been able to operate in power but also co-opting social movements, and these dynamics of clientelism, of cronyism have crept in and have really divided the social movements. So this is the kind of the longer term sort of problem that has been, that we can see afflicting the mass, and one of the main reasons why it has totally collapsed today. But really, if we kind of also think about the specter here of Evo Morales. Now, 20% of the votes in the election on Sunday were nulo, or spoiled ballots. Now, not all of this is due to support for Evo. So Evo instructed his supporters to spoil their ballots in protest at the fact that he wasn't on the ballot. He wasn't on the ballot because he, for two reasons. One, of constitutional term limits, which mean that he's not actually legally able to run. But in the kind of more technical aspect, he wasn't able to get a party together to be put onto the ballot. So Evo wasn't a candidate. His voters seem to have come out and yet voted nulo, so they've spoiled their ballots. But also a lot of those nulo votes will be from disillusioned voters who are kind of fed up of the entire array of candidates. This is actually, I think, quite a common sort of feeling at the moment. There's a real sense of disillusionment with politics of all, and politicians of all stripes. But this question of Evo has really been this kind of cloud over the mass. I mean, the longer sort of trajectory of this, we can probably trace to, well, at least the coup of 2019. So Evo was ousted through this confluence of right-wing actors. But really, that also was due to the fact that Evo went against a referendum in 2016, which said whether people voted no to his attempt to run again. He ran again anyway, and that was a factor in the coup. But yes, these internal divisions have absolutely destroyed the mass. And really, this is why we can what we can see in the electoral failure of the elections. They did win. So Eduardo del Castillo, who was the Minister of the Interior under Luis Arce, he was the mass candidate. And he won he made it over the 3% threshold, which means that the mass can still be a functioning party, because under Bolivian electoral rules, if a party does not get 3% out of the presidential candidates, it has to dissolve. So the mass still survives, which will be crucial for the future. Here, I should probably mention that Andronico Rodriguez, who is the kind of protege figure behind Morales, he made the decision to run with a separate party, Alianza Popular. Now, polls all along suggested he would not do particularly well, and that is the outcome we saw. So he won 8% of the vote, which is, kind of testament to the collapse of the left and of particularly of kind of rural support for the mass and for those affiliated with the mass.
Olivia Origo-Styles, thank you so much for coming on the program and explaining this to us.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here.
Thank you, everyone, as always, for listening. If you haven't yet, check us out on Apple Podcasts and review us, not just check us out, obviously. Also, please consider joining the Discord. Again, not only are they smart and interesting people, but they are good people. And as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Dreaming of blissful summer days and creamy popsicles? Capture sun-drenched memories with the Orange Vanilla Dream Hydration Multiplier from Liquid IV. Just one stick and 16 ounces of water can help hydrate you better than water alone. Live your summer dream with Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code INDULGE20 at checkout.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.